Through this season of Advent, we'll be reading from Ephesians 3, verses 17 to 19. Then Christ will make his home in your hearts as you trust in him. Your roots will grow down into God's love and keep you strong. And may you have the power to understand, as all God's people should, how wide, how long, how high, and how deep his love is. May you experience the love of Christ, though it is too great to understand fully. Then you will be made complete with all the fullness of life and power that comes from God.
Christmas is one of the few seasons that we still prepare for. Some of us start in January, some of us start in June, some of us start December 23rd. But no matter when you start, you do look into the future and anticipate the season of Christmas and do things to prepare for it. We trim trees, we scour the house for bathrobes and towels to make questionable nativity costumes, we wrap presents and plan meals, and in other years we'd book flights or prepare guest rooms. Danish philosopher Soren Kierkegaard once said that hope is a passion for the possible. And I would say that preparation is the tangible expression of that passion. If we hope for something, if we truly believe it to be possible, we'll prepare for it. And Living Waters, this Advent season, we want to be prepared for Jesus. So we're taking the phrase, "Let every heart prepare him room," as the name of our series from the hymn Joy to the World. And we're going to spend the next 4 weeks in Ephesians 3, 17 to 19, the verses that were just read for us. Today, I'll talk about trust. Next week, Rachel Schock will talk about roots. The week after that, Luke will talk about experience. And the week after that, Dave will talk about abundance. Now, these words in Ephesians 3, 17 to 19, they're a prayer. And we don't want to just talk about this prayer, we want to be shaped by it. So we're encouraging church-wide, all families, all ages, to take this as a memory verse over the Advent season. You know, one of the reasons that it takes hope to prepare for something is because the future is always uncertain. And let me tell you, if 2020 was a theme park, the future is uncertain would be the names over the, be the words over the gate. Masky the mascot would be running around being like, who knows what's going to happen? You know, if you want to talk to somebody about uncertainty, if you wanted to talk to somebody about not having control over things, one of the people you could talk to would be my dad. And see, my dad's a farmer, which he'll tell you takes about as much stomach as being a professional gambler. In fact, he would probably say it takes more because the odds are usually less in his favor than they would be for the gambler. And I can remember one particular year, I think I was 13 or 14, I knew something was up, something really bad had happened. My dad was really distraught. And we went to church on a Sunday, and in that tradition, we would have a time of testimony. And my dad stood up and started to testify, and he said that there had been an early frost and 3/4 of his entire crop was wiped out just like that. We're talking tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars of inputs gone to waste in a few short hours in one evening. The precious lifeblood of his canola froze up, the plants got brittle, they had never gone to seed. Leaves blackened, withering in his hands. He stood up in church and he said, the morning that that happened, he was sitting in our yard in the cold morning sun, and he was mad at God. He started talking to him, and not talking very nice. He said, don't you see anything, God? And just that moment, Dad says a sparrow landed not 2 feet in front of him and started chirping at him, looking him right in the eyes and chirping right in his face. And he said he heard clear as anything he's ever heard, he heard the voice of God say, I see that sparrow. You know, I can imagine that it's taken a lot more hope to prepare for Christmas this year than it ever has before. But uncertainty about the future, a lack of control, that's nothing new. In fact, that's not even really a problem. The thing that's new is the fact that we're all experiencing it all at once. But you know what is a disease that needs to be cured? To face any of these things alone. See, my dad tells this story still, not because after that moment God went and miraculously restored his crops, but because he knew from that moment on that he knew he had never been nor would ever be alone facing anything, that God was with him. Now, these words in Ephesians 3:17-19, they're a prayer by the Apostle Paul, a prayer to Gentiles who had just joined the fulfillment of the Jewish faith. They're kind of new to this thing, and the faith had been facing some problems. Paul actually, just a few verses before, talks about suffering for the faith. And in light of this suffering, it's interesting to notice what he prays for. He doesn't pray, may God solve all of these problems for us, or may God make us rich and certain at what's going to happen, or even may God whisk us away to heaven. No, he prays that Christ would make his home in our hearts as we trust in him. He prays for such a deep experience of intimacy with God that it borders on the heretical for some people. Now, he prays this because, as many people will tell you, one of the things that helps us accomplish incredible things is knowing that we're not alone. One of the most basic needs human beings have for flourishing is to be known and to be loved and to be believed in. So when we talk about loneliness, we're talking about something that is a brokenness that the gospel of Jesus Christ has come to mend. You know, we talk about the gospel a lot as God solving the problem of our eternal salvation or our right standing in front of God. But the first thing that God said was a problem was that the first human being was alone. So, of course, the redeeming work of Jesus Christ has got to do something about that fundamental issue. Now, John Ortberg once had this beautiful little turn of phrase about loneliness in the modern world. He said, we modern people, we are seldom alone, but often lonely. But Jesus was often alone and never lonely. You see, Paul's prayer in Ephesians is that we would experience through Jesus the thing that Jesus experienced when he was on earth, an unbroken sense of God's attention and affection. See, loneliness in this case, the loneliness that we face, it's not as much a problem of proximity as we think it is. I think that many of us being physically isolated more than we've ever been, that physical isolation, I think, is actually just kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for some of us. It's just bringing to light a disconnectedness we had been feeling for a very long time. It's just making evident an illness that was already there. Because loneliness is not a problem with proximity. It's actually a problem with intimacy. So facing dire odds, Paul wants us to experience intimacy with God. And he describes it in a way that makes this intimacy sound like it's unbroken, like it's an attention and affection that we just cannot stop, which is hard for some of us to believe. Not least of which because people like me get up and talk about God and make him sound like a hormonal 14-year-old. The God that we talk about sounds more like a Katy Perry song than the God of Scripture. He's hot then cold, he's yes then no, he's in then out, he's up then down. One wrong word, one wrong look, and it goes from I love you to I hate you and a door being slammed in your face. And this is not at all the reality that Paul is describing. The impetus for this love is all on God's part in this passage. It's wide as the horizon. It's vaster than any understanding we could possibly have. But this opening verse is so intimate because the most intimate thing that any person can do with any other person is live with them. That's still true for us in the modern world. We don't live with other people unless we are intimately connected with them and trust them implicitly. And Christ isn't just wanting to visit every once in a while. He's not wanting to go on a casual date. He wants to make his home with us. Friends, Love is waiting for you. Love is waiting for you like the sun waits for you to get up each morning. Love is waiting for you like the rain waits to gently kiss the dry ground. Ephesians 3:20 tells us Jesus is at the door knocking, waiting for someone to open the door. Love is waiting for you. So the question is, will you let him in? You know, I can imagine that the answer would be yes. I pray that the answer is yes, but I can also imagine that the answer would be yes, but how? I mean, I've been around this church stuff for a long time. What am I missing? Well, see, loneliness is a problem not with proximity as much as it is intimacy, especially when it comes to God, because God's attention and affection are unbroken. And any problem with intimacy is ultimately a problem with trust. Right? That image of Jesus standing outside the door, right? A door is a defense mechanism. A door is something we use to keep the world out. It's the people inside that control whether the door opens or closes. Now, the verse tells us the responsibility that we can take, really the only responsibility we can take in this whole passage, as far as I can see it, are those words, as you trust in him, Christ will come and make his home in his heart, home in your heart, as you trust in him. Now, in Greek, it's actually just two words, by and faith. And Luke talked about this a couple weeks ago and did a wonderful job of it, so there's not much ground to cover here, but the Greek word for faith does carry the connotation of to believe in, which is usually the way we use it as a very rational thing, to think right thoughts, right? Our statements of faith are lists of characteristics of God and the actions of God. But the word faith also carries the connotation to rely on or have confidence in or to prove, to trust. And trust is a relational word. Let me prove it to you. So imagine you want to go tandem skydiving. And you're morbid as any other human being who's ever existed. So the first thing you do is you go on Google and you look up the odds of dying when you skydive. Perfectly natural. And you would find that on most sites, they'll tell you there's about a 0.000002% chance of dying in a skydiving accident. That's 1 in 500,000. You get super morbid and you go and check out other odds of dying. And you find that dying in a motor accident has the odds of about 1 in 106, and I think that was in the States in 2018. So 1 in 500,000 versus 1 in 106. But I can guarantee you, you get in a plane with nothing but a sheet and some strings strapped to your back, and that plane takes off, and your heart's going to start beating, your palms are going to start sweating, your breathing's going to get rapid. Why? Well, because trust is a relational thing. Far more than it is a rational thing. You need to experience something in order to gain trust with it. Now, that's not to say that trust is irrational. It has its own logic, right? As Blaise Pascal once said, the heart has its reasons, which reason knows nothing about. It's more like it's pre-rational. It needs to be fast because it's connected to that bodily defense mechanism called fear, that thing that gives us energy to run away or to fight. Right? Trust is basically just the damper on how fast your fear response kicks in. So the only way to really truly grow in it is with direct experience. It's with conditioning. See, love is waiting for you. And Paul's telling us trust is how you let him in. And trust is far more relational than it is rational. So come back with me to that verse in Revelation 3 where Jesus is knocking at the door. A lot of people who talk about that verse neglect the context. The context of that verse is that Jesus is actually talking to a church that's grown lukewarm, a church that is not placing their trust in him. And essentially what Jesus does as a result of that is he leaves. He doesn't go far. The proximity doesn't change. The attention and affection don't change. He's there at the door knocking, which leads me to the conclusion that Jesus isn't in that place, isn't deeply intimate with it because they don't want him to be. And it's been my experience, my general experience for most people that I talk to and for myself, that God is really only ever as intimate with us as we let him be. Now, there, let me put a pin in something here. There are many people who earnestly seek God with their time and their actions and have an experience of distance or coldness or other things like that. There are great heroes of the faith that we know have experienced that. That happens. However, the general rule most of the time is God is about as intimate with us as we let him be, because he's a good lover. And good lovers concede to the consent of their beloved. They do not force themselves upon the ones they love. So trust is how we let him in, and we've got to learn how to grow in it then. Now, one of the reasons I like the word trust is because if you go through the history of the word faith, almost all of the metaphors for it are just like huge. They're grand, right? Soren Kierkegaard, my favorite writer on faith, I've learned a ton from him, but he describes faith as a leap. And the person who has faith is the knight of faith, right? And he literally says once, to have faith is to lose one's mind so as to win God, right? It's everything's huge and drastic and dramatic. It was his way. Blaise Pascal once wrote that faith, the life of faith is like a wager, a gamble, a throw of the dice, a good wager. The odds are good, but it's still a gamble. You know, Jesus didn't use either of these metaphors. There's a marvelous little passage in Matthew 17. The disciples are sent out on mission and given the authority to preach and to cast out demons, but they get a particularly hard case. There's a young boy that they can't cast the demon out of, and when they come back to Jesus, the boy follows them. Jesus solves the problem, quick, fast, in a hurry. And the disciples seem a little perturbed. They're like, Jesus, why couldn't we do this? And Jesus says, well, because you're little faiths. Now, this is Jesus' like nickname for the disciples. He calls them this all throughout the Gospels. But you can tell this time it struck a chord for some reason, because it seems like Jesus softens after that moment. And he says, but I tell you the truth. If you had faith as little as a mustard seed, you could say to that mountain, move from here to there, and it would be moved. Nothing would be impossible for you. Well, my friends, this is a mustard seed, which I'm told you can't even see, which is kind of the point. I was eating my feelings one night during the pandemic, like many of us are, well, cooking my feelings so I could eat my feelings. And I was trying out a South Indian recipe, and in this recipe you need dried mustard seeds, and I'd never seen a dried mustard seed before. So I go into the store and I look at this thing and I'm like, huh, neat. Because I'm reminded of Jesus's words, and this ain't big. But as I thought about it more, I remembered that there's a whole lot of sand in ancient Palestine. Like, if Jesus wanted to just tell us that we only need a little bit of faith, that we only need something small, there were other things available to him. And then as I was meditating on it this week, you know, I noticed something, remembered something, really, and that's that, well, seeds aren't just small, they grow. So maybe faith isn't an all-at-once leap off the edge. Maybe it's not all in on one roll of the dice. Maybe Jesus is saying that trust grows with him much the way it does with many other things, by small investments made over and over and over again, day in and day out, until our faith grows into a forest that others can find reprieve in. How do we let our hearts prepare room for Jesus in this season? Well, for some of us, it's going to be just a little bit at a time. And what better way to engage in that than in prayer? Because what else is prayer but taking your whole self, all your hopes and your fears and your doubts, and placing them in the gentle hands of your loving Father? You know, the biggest thing we can ever trust anybody with is just ourselves, as we are. And what is prayer but making ourselves known to God, which is desperately important work. As Thomas Merton once said, it's desperately important work because to be unknown of God is altogether too much privacy. So I'd ask you, where's your little seed of faith today? Where have you got a scrap of trust left if it's hard for you and you've been alone? Give God an inch, he'll take the horizon. Give him a little seed and he can move a mountain, I'm sure of it. And if all you've got is the trust to ask him why he isn't doing anything, to ask him if he even sees anything, don't be surprised if he answers you.